Welcome to Talking APAC, a podcast series brought to you by the Australian Psychology Accreditation Council, or APAC for short. We're the organisation that ensures the quality of psychology programs offered by higher education providers in Australia. APAC acknowledges the Australian Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples as the traditional caretakers of the land, and we pay our respects to elders, past and present. My name is David Glanz, and I'm recording this podcast on the land of the Wurundjeri people, one of the five Kulin nations. Today we're talking about artificial intelligence, ChatGPT and that sort of thing, and what it means for learning and teaching, not least in the psychology discipline. Now, it's very quickly become a tradition for the journalists to reveal that they've pranked their audience by declaring that everything so far has been written by ChatGPT. Wow, look how clever AI is. You can't tell the difference between it and the real thing. But I haven't used ChatGPT because, well, that would be cheating, wouldn't it? And here's the conundrum for academics. AI is everywhere. Students are going to use it because they can. There are arguments about whether staff should use it to speed up mundane jobs. But how much AI is too much AI? And what's the line between efficiency, research, and plagiarism? To answer these and other questions, I'm talking today to Dr. Guy Curtis. Guy is a senior lecturer in the School of Psychological Science at the University of Western Australia, and his main research focus at present is on individual differences related to plagiarism, cheating, and leadership. So welcome, Guy.
Hi there, thank you.
Now, you wrote in The Conversation last year, and this was really before the ChatGPT craze really took off, and I'm going to quote you. "The worst kind of university cheating is also the hardest kind to catch, and more students do it than previously thought. Until recently, it was thought about 2 to 4% of Australian university students submitted assignments written by someone else. Our new research suggests the real figure is more like 8 to 11%. And over 95% of students who cheat in this way are not caught." And by the way, I'll put the link to this article and any others referenced below in the podcast description. So with AI rampant on the scene, is academia fighting a battle it's doomed to lose?
That is a good question. So we have, through the history of university teaching and assessment, always dealt with new and emerging technologies that can potentially undermine the way assessment is done and the validity of assessment. So if we think about assessment from the point of view of psychologists and the way psychologists tend to think of assessment, we often talk about validity. We want our tests to be valid, and that is measuring what they're supposed to be measuring. And when it comes to educational assessment, what we want is our assessments to be measuring what they're supposed to be measuring, which is whether students have learnt the course content, whether they have achieved unit learning outcomes or course learning outcomes, depending on how these things are phrased. And if students use a technology that produces an assignment for them, or they get another person to produce an assignment for them, or they copy and paste information that's written by someone else that answers the question but didn't involve any demonstration of their own thinking or production of ideas, undermine the validity of assessment. And so it's an ongoing battle because the technology changes. If we go back to the 1970s, photocopiers actually were a technology that was very disruptive to the validity of assessment, because all of a sudden people could copy things from books or written by students in previous years that they hadn't been able to copy easily before. And you could almost say the same thing about the printing press, although that would be drawing a bit of a long bow in the history of psychology academia, of course. But it's true as well of the internet that when the internet came along, people were concerned that the internet would be a rampant source of plagiarism because students would copy and paste things from the internet. But what very quickly became apparent was that the internet also gave educators the opportunity to very quickly find the things that students had copied and pasted. And over time, automated and looked like text matching software that would scour the internet and databases that would find the things that students had copied and pasted. So although the technology battlefront now is probably generative AI more than anything else, it's still something for which there's a bit of a co-evolutionary arms race, that as the means of cheating get change and adapt to the environment, so potentially to the means of detection. So this is where we will go going forward, I think.
Now, just before we go back to sort of the technology itself, a little bit about the psychology of cheating. In that article you wrote, you talked about why students can be evasive in admitting cheating, even in anonymous surveys. So what's the psychology of cheating? And would a student using ChatGPT for an assignment even think they were cheating?
Yeah, that's a good question. So what constitutes cheating is something that's determined by higher education institutions. Sometimes it can even be at the level of a single assignment, that something that might be considered cheating in a particular assignment may not be considered cheating in another assignment. There may be assignments at university being set at the moment, there probably are now, where academics are requiring students to use a generative AI technology like ChatGPT, because learning to use these technologies is probably a good idea. We are going to be using them in the future. And so it would be a requirement to use that. Whereas for some assignments, using that technology may be something that the academic doesn't permit, and therefore it's going to be considered cheating if a student uses it. So the definition of cheating is something that's really important in all this consideration. And whether students know something is cheating, it has to be communicated to them by their higher education institution and by their teaching staff. So universities need to develop policies around the use and acceptable use of generative artificial intelligence within their institutions. At my institution, University of Western Australia, we amended our academic integrity policy within the first couple of months of 2023 to deal with the fact that ChatGPT had come out in November 2022, to make it clear to students what was permissible use and what was impermissible use, and that they should always be looking to their unit coordinators, their academic staff, their lecturers, their tutors, to find out what was going to be allowed. So if you look at the kinds of things that have always constituted potentially plagiarism, there are some that reliably students don't know very well. One of those, for example, is self-plagiarism or recycling of work. If we get a student who has submitted an assignment previously and then they resubmit that in another class, or they resubmit parts of that in another class, a lot of students don't know that that's against most universities' rules on academic conduct, simply because it's an educational thing that they're not told, or even if they are told, it's one that they seem to easily forget. I'm not quite sure what it is with that, but the understanding of cheating has to come from a policy, but that policy has to be communicated.
And just stepping back to your article, you were talking about contract cheating in that article, and that's pretty black and white when you pay someone else to write an essay for you. I don't think anybody could think it's anything other than cheating. But students were still quite reluctant to admit that they'd done it, even when they knew they were anonymous. So what's going on there?
There's a big literature in psychology on essentially the surveying of sensitive information. And that crosses over into various other fields as well, like public opinion research and things like that. So if a topic is sensitive or deeply personal, so something about, say, sex or sexuality, or something about habits that people wouldn't want other people to know about, like picking their nose, they'll tend to underreport those things in surveys for a number of reasons. One of those reasons is that a survey, you've got no particular reason to be truthful. Another reason is that sometimes people don't like to admit these things to themselves. And a third reason that's quite common is that sometimes students or people do not trust anonymous surveys. So what they will do in a situation of an anonymous survey is think, there's possibly some chance that I might get identified in the process of doing this. Maybe they're looking at my computer IP address or something like that as I'm answering this survey online, or maybe there's something about my handwriting on this paper survey that will give away who I am. So there's a reluctance to admit to negative behaviours, sensitive information within surveys.
Mm-hmm. Obviously, there's a range of people across academia who are grappling with the challenges of AI. Professor Philip Dawson from Deakin University has argued that the use of AI is a form of cognitive offloading, meaning using a tool to reduce mental load. And accordingly, he recommends that universities should make clear to students the forms and degree of cognitive offloading permitted for specific assessments, with AI increasingly incorporated into higher level tasks. And he says, and I quote, "I think we'll actually be teaching students how to use these tools. I don't think we're necessarily going to forbid them." And you've sort of hinted at that already, but what's your view on Professor Dawson's take?
Yeah, so Phil Dawson's idea of using these tools as cognitive offloading makes a lot of sense. If you look at the psychology literature on automation, and my colleague here at University of Western Australia, Shane Loft, does a lot of work on the psychology of automation and working with automated systems. Essentially, automated systems can replace human input, or they can augment human input. And the augmenting of human input means that it's doing something for us while there's still a role for the human, and it might be taking away some part of a task or making some part of a task easier. Whereas automating the input means that it's doing it all for us without any human input, and maybe human oversight might be very minimal in a situation of an automated process. And the augmenting of human work by AI obviously frees up a lot of possibilities for us to do other things really well. And I'll put this into a nice context of educational assessment. If you're looking at a student's written work, what you will often find is that in that written work at a university level, there might be some part of the assessment that gives them marks for clear writing, good grammar, something like that. Now, generative AI technologies and writing assistant technologies like Grammarly and ChatGPT and some of these other things have the possibility of making all students' writing clear. Now, if all students' writing was clear, there's no point giving them grades for it, because that's then just automated. And as an assessor, what you can do is you can devote all the marks to the content rather than the expression. Now, that's a really nice thing, I think, to be able to do going forward. But it will take a bit of thinking around assigning marks within assessments. It will take a bit of thinking around, are we at the point of uptake of these technologies that we can just expect students to be writing clearly? And those sorts of things are ongoing discussions. But the capacity to, say, cognitively offload, to use Phil Dawson's term, the clarity of writing, it's potentially a really good thing for assessment and what we actually assess about students' work and understanding it in higher education.
Now, another expert who's sort of weighed into the discussion is Dr. Helen Neal, who directs the Higher Education Integrity Unit of the Tertiary Education Quality and Standards Agency, which I'm sure most listeners just know as TEQSA. And she sees the issues around AI as an opportunity, a chance for institutions to, quotes, think about what they are teaching and the most appropriate methods for assessing learning in that context. So does your research and personal experience to date bear this out as a strategy?
Yeah, I think Helen is right about this, that AI has given lots of higher education institutions a bit of a shock to make us think about how we're doing assessment. Certainly the case in some disciplines more than others. Think, for example, about mathematics. In mathematics, we've had calculators for a very long time. And when calculators came along, maths had to shift from people being expected to do a lot of mental maths to the understanding that people could quite easily get calculators to do really the arithmetic for them, and then they might have to get them to learn and assess them on other skills. Now, over the last few years, maths programs have become significantly more sophisticated than what calculators could do. So now you can put a maths problem into most maths programs and get the workings as well as the outcome. Now, when people were designing maths assessments, what they were doing is saying, well, you need to show your workings, and that's how we can see you haven't just used a calculator to get to the outcomes. But of course, showing the workings is now something that most maths programs will do also. And we're at that kind of point now in the written assessment disciplines, so the humanities, the social sciences, and to some extent psychology, because in psychology we do have a lot of written work, we have reports and things like that, where we probably want to be thinking about assessing the process and understanding what students do so that we can see what and how they do it, not just the outcome, because getting them to just complete the work and assess what they've done at the end doesn't show how they got there. Now, we're also fortunate with technology that there are some systems around that will allow us to do that. So, for example, there are assessment systems, and just one that comes to mind is CADMUS. I know there's others like PowerNotes, and there's certainly a few others, where what students do is within these programs, and you can see the process that they've gone through in writing. So with a system like that, you can see whether someone is copying and pasting in output from a program like ChatGPT and editing it, or you can see whether they are writing something from scratch, and you can give them feedback on that process. And it may be the case that copying and pasting in something from ChatGPT at the start of what they're doing, prompting their ideas, much like copying and pasting in the first search results they get out of Google, is a good place for some students to start, and that's fine. But it takes knowing what students do in order to be able to provide that feedback. And we typically don't do that with most of our assessments at the moment. So I think higher education institutions really have to think about how we are assessing. And as Helen said, we're right that this emergence of new AI technology that's really pertinent to writing is getting us all to think about that very hard.
Mm. As you were saying that, I was just thinking, this is something that those of you in WA were exempt from, but on the East Coast, and I'm here in Victoria where we had the longest lockdown, academics had to work out how to do assessments with students online in new circumstances where you could no longer get the students into the room and actually see what they were doing and whether or not they were cheating. And there had to be a whole process of students, and it was fairly ad hoc, I think, but a whole process of students, in a sense, showing how they were working while they were actually being assessed online. So obviously academics can be very nimble when they have to be.
That's right. Yes, and I think with the COVID lockdowns, we had a rethink of assessment. In a lot of places around the world, we had lots of issues in academic integrity that arose from that, though, with unsupervised online assessments being readily cheatable, with take-home exams being readily cheatable or easily outsourced. And so there's been some significant concerns in that area, and it's something that still needs attention, I think.
Now, as you've said, technology such as ChatGPT can help fix mistakes with spelling and grammar. And as a side note, I feel very redundant. I've been a sub-editor for most of my working life. And actually, I've been a gatekeeper for spelling and grammar and clarity of reading. And I now find myself facing down at the end of my career the barrel of redundancy, because if ChatGPT can do that job, then a job like mine is no longer relevant. Is it cheating, though, for students to use ChatGPT to make their writing better? And if it isn't cheating, what is?
So there has to be, as we discussed earlier, that idea of defining what cheating actually is. And I'll give you an example from the University of Western Australia, where I am, with our academic integrity policy, including a section on what was called allowable editorial assistance, or authorised or unauthorised editorial assistance are included within that policy. So editorial assistants previously have been thought of as having someone look over your work and give you feedback. And we had some rules around what was allowable there, which partly was to try to encourage undergraduate students in particular to be self-critical, to learn how to edit their own work, and to not outsource that to other people. And the kind of editorial assistance that's permissible would include things like pointing out where something was unclear rather than rewriting something for they had written something that was unclear. So this was guiding rather than doing. And so what a technology that can clarify work for someone does is potentially getting into that area of doing rather than guiding. And then institutions have to make a decision about whether that is okay, because at the same time as that has done something for a student, the student still has to make a decision about whether what the technology has done to their writing is what they wanted to say. Has it changed it? Has it, by making it clearer, also made it wrong? So there's a fair bit to think about and unpack there. And what we, the conclusion of at University of Western Australia, and I think we will keep revisiting this policy for a while as the technology changes, is that we are happy for students to use AI to edit their work, but we are not happy for students to use AI to have generated all the work in the first place. So we want the researching of the work, the original writing of ideas for the most part to be done by students rather than the generation of ideas. So it's a fine balance, and it's one that will also take a fair bit of work in trying to police. But certainly it's something where just using technology to make your writing clearer. We've had spell check and grammar check built into Microsoft Word for more than a decade, is not something that people would typically consider to be cheating.
No, just on that note, most people default to the US version of spelling in Microsoft Word without realizing it, which is why we now have a whole generation of people who can't tell the difference between Australian English and American English on some key words, but that's just me being a bit bitter and twisted. APAC's vision is to improve societal well-being through ensuring high-quality education and training in psychology. So in other words, we want to help higher education providers to graduate psychology students who can go on to help rather than damage their patients. Do you see any challenges ahead posed by AI that are specific to the field of psychology?
Yes, there's definitely some potential challenges posed by AI specifically to psychology. And I'll take one really specific example straight off, which is apps that people use for counselling that could be driven by AI technology. So because you think of something like ChatGPT, it's a chat bot. You can ask it questions using human language and it'll give you answers back using human language. You could very easily, with a technology like that, provide around emotional issues where people are seeking advice for psychological and mental health problems. Now, that can then be built into an app, and people could sell that app as a counselling app. And one of the problems that we have is that the Therapeutic Goods Association in Australia does not regulate those kind of apps or mental health related apps. So if we were to think of a situation like that, the generative pre-trained transformer, that's the GPT in ChatGPT, the pre-trained part is a matter of what goes in determining what comes out. So if people have trained their chatbot in a way that doesn't provide sound, solid, evidence-based responses to people's questions, isn't sufficiently adaptive to the way that people are asking it questions or what they're telling it in response, that can be a significant problem because it may provide really damaging kinds of advice or answers. If you look at the way that ChatGPT, which came onto the market or the world stage in November 2022, was developed, they actually had hundreds of people paid to test it, to run things through it, or change the kinds of responses it gave to certain kinds of questions. One of the kinds of things that it was trained for was to try to stop it from helping students to cheat. So if you write into ChatGPT, "Will you do my homework for me?" it will give you a sort of predetermined answer of, "No, I will not do your homework for you. That would be unethical." But if you just put your homework question in, it will give you the answer to your homework question. Similarly, we could strike a situation like that with mental health kinds of questions with a generative pre-trained transformer chatbot AI app for mental health, where if they haven't trained it to give appropriate responses when people are expressing serious mental health problems, say suicidal ideation, it could be absolutely terribly dangerous. So there's definitely significant cause for concern. And that's just one example of where there may be really big problems.
Now, back in my day as an undergraduate student, and we are talking about the last millennium, of course, the basic tool for checking our work was the handwritten essay, and there was limited scope for cheating. Do you see student assessment going back to the future? Are we going to see a return to non-fakeable assessments like handwritten essays, or for that matter, verbal questioning? Is there any scope for that? Is that, given the pressures that academics are already under with workload, I mean, is that even conceivable?
There's a few parts to that question. So let's start with handwritten essays. Interestingly, within a few weeks of ChatGPT coming out, someone posted online a picture of attaching a pen to a 3D printer so that it would handwrite answers that were generated by ChatGPT to look like handwriting. So if handwriting is not done in the presence of someone else, it's not necessarily verifiable easily that it's the student's handwriting. Even if you student's handwriting, you'd have to have something that raises your suspicion. So we have, for example, I think it's a nice example. Back in the 60s, there's a statement in a book by Donald Trump's niece that his sister, and this was audio recorded, his sister talking about having done Donald's homework for him because he wasn't a particularly good student, but his sister ended up a federal court judge. So she was quite a good student and she did most of his homework. Now, that would have been in the days of handwritten things, and all of Donald Trump's teachers probably thought that handwriting was his rather than his sister's. They may have had no reason to suspect that there was any difference. Handwriting away from the classroom is probably not particularly helpful. The other situation where we have handwriting is in exams. And in exams, I'm thinking here of invigilated or proctored or supervised exams where we see people doing what they're doing. Now, exams are harder to cheat in than other things, but exams still can be cheated in. So there's no assessment that's perfectly immune from the possibility of cheating. And we do know, for example, that there have been documented cases of people hiring imposters to sit exams for them as well. Be that as it may, the other thing about exams is, of course, we know that exams are quite artificial in terms of what people do in their real work. They often test knowledge rather than, say, application or synthesis. They don't necessarily test research skills or people's capacity to find information. There's lots of things that they don't test. So if we only assess things that students do using exams, we're not really assessing all the kinds of things that they would do in the workplace. We're not really assessing all the kinds of skills that we want them to have. So there's a real role for the kinds of assignments that students do, that they do themselves in their own time, that they take their time over, where handwriting or typing or however they go about doing it is actually really important for them to do as a skill. Now, as well as the handwriting, you also mentioned talking to students, the idea of asking them questions and getting verbal responses, or the idea of a voce viva, as it's sometimes called. So that's a really good idea. And that's something that, even though the scale of it can be huge, it's something that's potentially doable. So if you think of a class with a few hundred students, you may spend 10 minutes each with a voce viva, asking them questions and getting responses, and that will add up to an awful lot of time. But you'd also spend probably 20, 30 minutes each marking a written piece of assessment from them anyway. So the time there is, in fact, not much different. It's just the way that time is spread out and organized. So it's something that in a large class might have to be delegated to a number of markers, and then you would need to do some things to ensure some consistency and reliability. But it's not out of the question. Now, the other thing to think about potentially is what's called program-level assessment rather than unit-level assessment, that we don't necessarily need a exam in every unit. We don't necessarily need a spoken assessment or a Viva kind of assessment in every unit that a student does, but maybe at the end of their four-year degree, honours, where we're down to some smaller classes, if we have a oral presentation of 20 minutes from a student where they get some questions at the end in honours, then you've got that identity assurance, you've got that assessment where they're being asked about things at the level of their entire program potentially, rather than just at the level of an individual course or unit. And so there's a role for thinking about where we place these kinds of assessments. We can't have every assessment perfectly secured against cheating, but we do need to have some in that space somewhere in their program.
Well, the picture I'm getting is that the only thing that's certain in this situation is that nothing much is certain, and the process by which people test and assess will itself have to be tested and assessed against the emerging technology. Just out of interest, have any of your students submitted an assignment written by ChatGPT yet? And how could you tell? And if that has actually happened, what did you say to them?
So I know across universities around Australia, there's been a lot of students who have been either suspected of or detected using artificial intelligence to write assessments in various classes. And there are some confidentiality about particular students, particular cases and things like that. One of the things that we think about, though, if I just sort of pull back to a bigger picture in assessing whether students have engaged in any kind of academic misconduct, is the criteria for determining whether they have is usually on the balance of probabilities rather than beyond a reasonable doubt. And on the balance of probabilities, you would typically get various bits of probative information, probative evidence, things that will give you some hint of whether they have done the work themselves or they have done a work in a particular way that's unacceptable, and you'll put those together. Now, there's some detector technologies for generative AI written work that have a problem of generating false positives. And so falsely accusing students of academic misconduct on the basis of those is highly problematic and something that we need to be very careful with. But if those technologies, an entire assignment has been written by generative AI, it may well be worth asking the student questions that would test their knowledge and understanding of the work that might give you some understanding of whether they did in fact generate it rather than do it, and outright asking them, in fact, whether they have used generative AI. And one of the examples of this that came quite early on this year was an academic at an Australian university had a detector program flag three of their students as having used generative AI. And so that academic asked those students, did you do it? Because the program's saying you did it, and all three of them admitted to doing it. So, you know, obviously we can't just rely on confessions for everything. One example I'm aware of was a student who was asked to write a learning journal where they were given certain things to read by their academic staff member, and they were asked to summarise those readings, talk about the applications of those readings to the real world, and talk about their learning from those readings. And one of the learning journal entries that this particular student submitted had absolutely nothing to do with the reading, but could have been something that the reading might have been about, because the title was relatively ambiguous, the title of that reading. So it looks like they put the title of the reading into a generative AI and said, write me a reflective piece about this thing. And because the academic knew the reading and knew that the reading wasn't about what was written, that academic staff member looked at that learning journal entry and went, okay, this isn't about the right topic. And also, looking at the style of this, it looks very much like it is the style of thing that ChatGPT writes. So it was sort of three sentence paragraphs with a in conclusion paragraph at the end, which is the sort of high school essay kind of format that ChatGPT will often produce its answers in. So one of the things that academics can do is run their questions, their assignments, their assessments through ChatGPT or similar programs to see what answers it gives so that they have some idea what they're looking for as well.
Yes, this throws me back to schoolboy days when someone would cheat an exam by looking over someone's shoulder, and then the person they were cheating from had the wrong answer anyway. So they went down in a flaming heap. So, yeah.
Yeah, and just to jump in on that, one of the things that ChatGPT is known for doing is making up references. So we have, for example, text matching software that looks at whether text is written somewhere else, and most of the time a reference list and entries in a reference list will match to other sources, because if a reference is right and other people have used it, of course it will match to another source. But if a reference doesn't match to another source, or the authors don't go with the article title which doesn't go with the journal title or something like that, it could well be that ChatGPT has mashed up a reference out of different bits of information, different authors, different article title, different journal title. And again, that can be a clue that that's where students have generated that information from.
All right. This has been absolutely fascinating. Is there anything you'd like to add, Guy?
With academic integrity and artificial intelligence, there's of focusing on the shiny object in the room, which is that this is our new problem and this is what we should be worried about. And what I can see going on in the world of contract cheating, which is a particular area of research for me, which is where students outsource their assignments to other people to write them, is that contract cheating has not gone away with the emergence of artificial intelligence. And one of the companies that provides live answers to questions that students post to their website is partnering with an AI technology company. Some of the writers of assignments for students are picking up that ChatGPT often doesn't do a very good job, and so students who have tried cheating using ChatGPT are going back to human writers to write things for them. So while ChatGPT and generative AI might be the shiny object that we're worried about, we also need to continue to be alert to other types of cheating that students might engage in.
All right. Well, this has been an absolutely fascinating conversation. I'd like to thank you very much for your time.
Thanks, David.